You're listening to the MLB At The Plate podcast, presented by National Car Rental. Go national, go like a pro. We're giving you the best content from each episode of MLB At The Plate. MLB At The Plate airs weekdays from 7 p.m. to midnight Eastern time on TuneIn. Now, here are your hosts, Holden Kushner and Ned Coletti.
Welcome into the MLB At The Plate podcast alongside Ned Coletti. I'm Holden Kushner, and we're going to start the podcast out with the MLB At The Plate triple play. It's where Ned and I discuss three topics that interest us. Tonight, we begin the triple play by updating the AL Cy Young race between Chris Sale and Corey Kluber on the night that Sale racked up his 300th strikeout of the season. Ned and I then will discuss the race for the top seed in the NL between the Nats and the Dodgers and the importance of avoiding two cross-country trips during a potential NLCS showdown. We finish up with a story from Ned's upcoming book, The Big Chair, where Mr. Coletti reveals Frank Sinatra's favorite boyhood team.
The MLB At The Plate triple play.
The last time an American League pitcher got the 300 strikeouts, it was Pedro Martinez of the Red Sox in 1999. Now, your guy, Clayton Kershaw, was the last pitcher to hit 300. He had 301 back in 2015, but again, the list since 1981. So what are we going back? 36 years now. Here's the list of pitchers with 300 strikeouts. Nolan Ryan, Randy Johnson did it multiple times. Clayton Kershaw, Pedro Martinez, Curt Schilling, Mike Scott, and Chris Sale. Mike Scott's the guy that nobody's getting. But Sale is also now 13 strikeouts away from Pedro's Red Sox record. He had 313 in that 1999 season. That's no small feat. And again, I know we're in a different era and everything, but 300 strikeouts does not happen very often in this day and age, despite hitters striking out so much. It's just been a very dominating season by Sale.
Oh, yeah. And first year in Boston, too. When you think about going to Boston, maybe the toughest place to play, especially for a new player coming in with a ton of expectation. But he's lived up to it. He's done very well, and you got a nice little notch on his belt tonight with number 300.
Well, just think about it, too. You know, Corey Kluber's not at 300. Who's Clayton Kershaw hasn't been healthy enough, but Max Scherzer isn't at 300. We just don't have many 300 strikeout guys these days. No. Now, you got batters that flirt with 300 strikeouts in a year. You don't have the pitchers doing it. So you look at Randy Johnson, right? He had 372 in 2001. Now, the big unit is this, to me, is the most dominating left-hander we've seen since Randy Johnson. Clayton Kershaw is the best pitcher in the game. Clayton Kershaw had 301 in 1 year. But when you just think of just flat-out domination, guys, a couple pitches going to get you. Chris Sale, to me, is that guy. Randy Johnson. And then, to my surprise, and you brought him up, Curt Schilling did it a couple of times. He had 319 in 97. Another 316 in 2002. Then you got Pedro, Randy Johnson again, and Mike Scott, who in 1986 was scuffing the ball like nobody we have ever seen before or since. Well, no doubt about it.
Oh, no doubt. And I can remember being in Davey Johnson's office in 1986 when the Mets and the Astros played in the LCS, and he had a dozen, might have two dozen, baseballs that they had collected from the night before, all kindly, artistically done in the same spot.
How did they not bust him?
Well,
everybody knew.
Yeah, I guess maybe everybody didn't know. Apparently didn't know because they...
I mean, it was an amazing run that he was on, but ultimately didn't get it. But that's Chris Sale. And again, you know, this is a magnificent performance, 8 shutout. He gets the 300 strikeouts this year. I still don't think it's going to be enough unless Corey Kluber just comes out with a couple of clunkers down the stretch. I don't think it's going to be enough for him to get back and catch Kluber because in the second half, Sale's numbers have been above average, whereas Corey Kluber's numbers have been otherworldly. And, you know, I'm not going to get into FIP and all the other stuff, but since coming off the DL, here's his ERAs in June. He had a 1.26, July 2.62. August, 1.96 ERA in 5 starts. September, 0.87 ERA in the 4 starts so far. I mean, he's just been remarkable. Corey Kluber has been the best pitcher in the game here in the second half. He is 10-1 with a 1.92 earned run average and 129 Ks in 98 in the third innings. So I love Chris Sale. I love what he's done. I thought Chris Sale was the Cy Young Award winner until a couple of starts ago when I started digging into Kluber's numbers. Kluber is the Cy Young Award winner, but Sale is the first pitcher in the American League to get the 300 since Pedro did it back in 99. Just my thoughts on the AL Cy Young.
Yep. It's what amazes me, not amazes me, but impresses me with Kluber is that this guy went to Game 7 of the World Series last year. He was pitching in November. Chris Sale wasn't pitching in November. And that he's been able to come back and have the kind of year he's had. And it's been some time out. But still, you gotta get back in the game. You got to get your rhythm back. You got to get your arm strength back and your command back. And he's been doing it. Really, really a great example of how good he is.
His whip is .850, which would be 12th lowest ever for a starting pitcher over a full season.
Ever is good,
Kluber.
Right? Ever is good?
Walks and hits an innings pitch. That's how great this guy has been. .85, which would have been this will be the 12th lowest ever in the history of the game. He had that 22-inning shutout streak during the big stretch that the Indians went on, winning, 22 games, right? Did they get to 23?
22.
That's right, 22. Most starts with two runs and fewer or seven or more Ks. Kluber has 16. Actually, Sale just picked up his 17th. So Sale's got him in that one. But again, Kluber has been great. But we're talking about Sale here reaching 300. Big time numbers for Chris Sale this year. Did you ever have any concerns when your team was playing out on the East Coast? I know there's a definite stat in football where teams like the Raiders and the Chargers, they go east. Their performance usually lacks. Does that translate to baseball?
I think it can a little bit. Typically, when you do fly west to east, you do it on an off day. So you do have a little bit of a time to acclimate. But where I always found it difficult, and I'm sure players had the same issue from time to time, you get back to the team hotel, it might be midnight, 12:30. Maybe you go to a late night spot and you get a little sandwich or something like that. And you end up maybe trying to fall asleep at 3 or 4 in the morning, East Coast time. Because think about it, if you're playing on the West Coast and you're really kind of working nights and you're getting home at midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, and then you try to unwind and go to sleep, it's 4 or 5 in the morning on the East Coast. And Manhattan, you know, there's no quiet place in Manhattan, not at 6, 7 in the morning anyway. And so you've got a lot of street noise, you got a lot of hustle and bustle inside a hotel. I think it's tough to sleep on the road like that. And I think after a while, maybe not the first day in, but maybe the second day in, typically it's the second day on a baseball team that you see a little bit of lag because of a time zone change. So I think it does affect it. And I think that's why sometimes home field advantage in the postseason matters more to a West Coast team than an East Coast team. Let's face it, an East Coast team's coming out to play. If they're playing at 8 o'clock Eastern, you know, that's not that unusual, really. That's when they're typically playing anyway. But if you're a National League team or any team going west to east and you're playing at 8 o'clock Eastern, that's 5 o'clock. It's a different thing. Your whole rhythm is off. And some guys who are very routine-oriented, a lot of starting pitchers are very, very routine-oriented. You got a little bit of a change in plans.
Oh, I'll tell you this much. I notice it making flights from D.C. out to L.A. I feel great. You know, you take the red eye out there, or you take the red eye back here, I'm exhausted, but take a flight out there, feeling great. You got a little extra time under your hands. Coming back to the East Coast really is a pain. And in the playoffs, you want every advantage possible. I mean, I don't care if it gives you a .0001 run probability more, every single advantage that you can have. So, you know, we look at the Dodgers here. You would think that they're going to wrap up home field advantage, but the way that they're playing right now, it's entirely possible that the Nationals catch them. Although, you know, the Nats are four back in the loss column. So the Dodgers 96-55. The Nationals,
and they're losing tonight
are 91
too. The Nationals are losing tonight too. It's just a lot of different things have to happen for a team to lose a 3 or 4 or 5 game lead. First of all, the other team that's chasing them is going to have to win too, and that's tough to do for everybody. Look at the Dodgers; they've lost the first two games in Philadelphia, but their magic number has gone down one each night because San Diego, who's 15 games under .500, is beating the Diamondbacks, who are 22 games over .500. So there's so many different things that have to happen in the course of a game, of a season.
All right, and just to let you know, the Dodgers just sent out an email that the NLDS and NLCS home games are sold out, the quickest that the club ever sold out. So just because the team is scuffling, those fans still want to pack that place.
Oh, there's a lot of anticipation for the postseason in L.A., no doubt. Lots of anticipation. People are excited about this team. Another big attendance year this year for L.A. A lot of great fan base here. They've been talking about this team. It's a talk everywhere I go. Everybody I see, they all got the Dodgers on their mind through to winning all those games early and also through the 16 out of 17 losses. They love this team. No surprise. That's a lot of seats, too, by the way, holding a cell for every game.
Was it 55?
Yep, 53 to 55.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that is a big...
It's a big yard.
Ned, The Big Chair, your book. I just got my copy last week, making a little dent in it right now. It's nice to get back to... First of all, it's nice to actually read a book. It's been a while for me. You know, everything's online these days. Everything's on my phone. I'm reading this, I'm reading that. It's nice to go a little old school here. Enjoy a book. I was sitting out on the patio the other day. It was great. When is it officially dropping? Because pre-sale is going on right now.
It's going on October 3rd, which is ironically, obviously I worked for the Dodgers and the Giants both. It happens to be the 66th anniversary of the shot heard around the world where Bobby Thompson beat the Dodgers in the playoff game in 1951 at the Polo Ground. So October 3rd will be the big release date.
Well, Ned Colletti, The Big Chair. Of course, some great stories. The Smooth Hops and Bad Bounces. I mean, come on. This is going to be good. I'm looking forward to finishing it. But let's get to some stories. You know, you and I, we've had dinner. We've talked about these stories before. And I couldn't wait for the book to come out because now everybody's going to have a chance. There's a million of them. But I just want to get a couple of different ones that you could share with our audience out here. And there's a lot more than what you're going to hear right now. But let's start with some fellow Italians, Sinatra, Lasorda, Colletti. Go from there.
Well, we had I had the honor to have dinner with Frank Sinatra one time. His opening act was a good friend of mine named Tom Dreesen. Tom's from the south side of Chicago, Cub fan, and I knew him through my Cub days. And I was in San Francisco actually with the Cubs, and Sinatra was performing, and Dreesen invited myself and one of our coaches, Billy Connors, out to see the show. And then on the way back, he invited us to have dinner with Frank and the party at a restaurant in San Francisco named Tommy Toy's. It used to be right across from the Transamerica building. And the restaurant is closed down except for the Sinatra party. So we go back there and we're having a great night. I mean, it was to be in his company was amazing. And about an hour into it, he starts talking baseball and starts talking about his affinity for the sport. And, you know, I said, well, I know that you and Tommy Lasorda are great, great friends. Tommy in his office had one wall with all sorts of movie stars, pictures, and Tommy on one wall. And then another wall, it was Tommy and Frank. The entire wall was Tommy and Frank. So I knew they were close. And he goes, you know, Tommy and I are great friends. But what I've never told Tommy is that I actually grew up a Giants fan. I grew up across the river from the Polo Grounds in Hoboken, New Jersey. I could see the lights at the Polo Grounds, and I really grew up a Giant fan. But I moved out to L.A. and became friends with Tommy. So, you know, I go to a lot of Dodger games. I'd see Tommy in his office after the game. So I've never really told him that. So years go by. Years and years go by, and it's now 1998, and I'm with the Giants. I've been with the Cubs when I hear this story, so I had no loyalty to the Giants at that point in time. I filed the story away. Sitting there and watching Oral Hershiser pitch for the Giants in 1998. I signed them for 1 year in San Francisco with Brian Sabian. 1998, we're playing a Saturday game at Dodger Stadium. So it's a little bit strange to see Hershiser in black and orange pitching at Dodger Stadium for the hated Giants, right? And we have no place to sit, Sabian and I. So Tommy asks us to sit with him in the booth, and Brian really doesn't want to do it. It's a nationally televised game. He doesn't want the cameras coming on and showing the Giants hierarchy with Tommy, who was then serving in the executive role as a GM, I believe. And it just didn't, you know, he didn't want to do it. But we had no place else to sit. So we end up sitting there, and we're kind of looking for conversation. I'm sitting between Brian and Tommy, and Brian's not saying anything. And for some reason, I brought it up to Tommy, and I says, you know, I heard one time that Frank Sinatra was actually a Giants fan. And Tommy goes crazy. And he's going, who told you that? And, you know, and the language is getting a little heated. And he's, I can't believe, you know, whoever told you that's a liar. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Who told you that? I says, well, you know, in all honesty, Tommy, the guy that told me would know. And he goes, I can't believe it. That's a lot of nonsense. You know, Frank and I, you know, if you ever saw my office, you saw all the photos. You know, he had season tickets here. He's here all the time, at dinner all the time. He wore, you know, wore a Dodger jacket every time I saw him. He's going on and on. He won't let the story die. And it goes on for about an inning. I'm trying to get out of the story. He's trying to keep it alive. And finally, he's relentless in badgering me on who told me this, because he wants to have a conversation with whoever told me this. And I said, well, if I tell you, I'm going to break your heart. I'd rather not tell you. And now he's standing up, like pointing at me. And I'm thinking, if this is on national television, this is quite the scene, right? And I continue to try and fight it. Finally, I tell him, hey, look, here's who told me. Frank himself told me. Tommy, he told me he loved you, that you're a great, great friend of his. But he grew up a Giant fan because of where he grew up in relation to the ballparks. And Tommy now is beside himself. And he looks at me and he looks at Saban. He goes, you guys, out. You got to get out. You can't be sitting here with me. You got to get out. So we get up. We walk out. We're in the concourse. And Saban looks at me and he says, you couldn't have told that story an inning or two earlier? Because he wanted obviously nothing to do with that to begin with. But, yeah, you know, it was – and unfortunately, Frank had already died. So, you know, the story lives in that manner because there's no other – the only people who heard the story were the people sitting at the table that night.
You think Tommy really believes it deep down in his heart?
Probably. One day, Tommy, you know, when we were working together, his office was about 90 feet down the road from me, and he showed up one day with a red golf shirt on, orange golf shirt on, and black pants. And I looked at him and I said, Tommy, did the lights go off at your house today? I mean, look at the color coordination you've got today. Did Frank give you that? And this is like 12 years after this story happens. And he looks at me, and we had never spoken about it when I took the job as the GM of the Dodgers. We had never talked about this night that I had with Sinatra after, you know, and what I told Tommy that day against 1998. And he looks at me and he says, I told you, I don't want to hear this ever again. And I didn't have to go any further than that. I just said, did Frank give you that black and orange outfit? And, you know, he never forgot it, but we never discussed it either.
All right. So, again, this is Ned's book coming out here, The Big Chair. And this is MLB at the Plate. He's Ned Coletti. I'm Holden Kushner. And Ned, of course, longtime GM of the Dodgers. Now, you know, I've been through some grueling interviewing processes in our business here in radio. But what's it like interviewing to be the Dodgers GM, Ned?
Well, I interviewed with Frank and Jamie McCourt, who both owned the team at that point in time. And it was over 3 days. It was a Friday, and then I came back on a Monday and a Tuesday. And it was about 24 hours worth of interview. And it was a relentless endeavor. Talking about two very, very smart people. And most of the interview was with Frank, but that it was nonstop. And I had a lot of questions, too, because they had, you know, they were running the Dodgers, and I was in San Francisco in a really good spot at a really good job with a bunch of people I really, really love working with. So are you going to leave the Giants for the Dodgers? Not just to do it, but if you're going to be the general manager, sure, you're going to take that opportunity. But it was maybe the most grueling interview I've ever had, easily. And it went for 3 days, spread with a weekend in between, about 24 hours total. And I learned how smart they are and how smart and what a businessman Frank McCourt is. And a lot of people in L.A. had didn't feel good about Frank at the end of his tenure here with the bankruptcy and the public divorce, so to speak. But the man really knew business. And what he showed me in that interview, I knew if I did get this opportunity and I accepted it, and I originally turned down his first offer, ironically, that I was going to be under a different type of heat than I'd ever been under before, just because of how he sees things and how his mind works. Maybe the best one-on-one negotiator I've ever been around, and somebody that a lot of courage in his negotiation, and was really somebody who taught me a lot. You know, you learn from everybody. And sometimes you learn stuff that you don't want to learn. And sometimes you learn stuff that's maybe not comfortable to learn. But there's education in every walk of life. And Frank taught me a lot of good stuff. Taught me a lot of stuff that obviously was a little bit on the other side of great stuff. You know, that you probably don't want to repeat. But there's so many great lessons in what he did teach me and how we went about it that... It was profound. So that actually takes up about 25 pages in the book because it is a step-by-step process, and I get into it. The book, it's a storytelling book. It's got a little bit of memoir to it, but it also, I think, has a little bit of life lesson to it, and it kind of tells people what it's like. So many people are into fantasy sports right now, and you get to be the GM. If you're running your fantasy league team, you're the general manager. But when you sit in that seat... The big chair is what my first boss, Dallas Green, used to call it. Dallas, unfortunately, passed away this past spring training, one of the great men of the game. You know, he used to tell me, so you want to sit in a big chair one day. And Jimmy Fry, who was a manager for the Cubs when I was there, and then my boss as a GM replacing Dallas, he used to say the same thing, hence the title, The Big Chair. But I think that you wonder what it's like if you sit on the outside. You may run your own fantasy league team, but you kind of wonder perhaps what it is really like on the inside. What's it like to negotiate with Scott Boras? Great negotiator. We lost Greg Maddux to Atlanta way back when, after Greg had pitched 6 years for the Cubs and had just won his first Cy Young. What was that negotiation like? What do you learn through negotiation? How do you negotiate? What steps went on? What went on a little bit behind closed doors? It's not a kiss and tell book or a revenge book. It's just kind of an informational book as how things happen. When I was with L.A., we traded for Manny Ramirez. How that trade came down. Came down to the last hours, really, of the trading deadline, coming down to a three-way deal with Pittsburgh, Red Sox, Dodgers, culminated on the last minute that it could possibly be done before the deadline. So things like that, the other big trade with the Red Sox, the other three-team, big nine-player deal that brought Adrian Gonzalez to L.A. and also brought a lot of contract to L.A., that's in there in a pretty detailed way. So it kind of gives fans a look inside of what it is like to be a GM and what it's like to be the assistant GM in San Francisco and to be an executive with the Cubs.
You're listening to the MLB at the Plate podcast presented by National Car Rental. Go national, go like a pro. And we'll be right back with more after this. There's hits and then there's all-time rock classics from the 60s and 70s. With classic rock hits on TuneIn, relive the very best sounds that defined an entire generation. If I ever get out of here, thought of giving it all away. Listen to the greatest rock songs in history with classic rock hits on TuneIn. And now, time for more of the MLB at the Plate podcast, presented by National Car Rental. Go national, go like a pro. Now, here are your hosts, Holden Kushner and Ned Coletti.
There were 15 games on Wednesday night, and to bring you up to speed on all the action, we got the best day ever, Home Run Tracker, and statistically speaking.
Best day ever, presented by National Car Rental. Go national, go like a pro.
All right, Ned, let's do the pitchers here. Where are we going? Where are you going, I should say, for your best day ever?
Well, he's somebody who's had many great days, but this might be one of the best days ever, despite being one of the best in baseball. Chris Sale, I'm going with Chris Sale. 8 innings, 4 hits, moved his record to 17-7, no runs, amazingly, no walks, but 13 strikeouts, including number 300 for the year. Very few guys have done that, and this guy has really lived up to expectation in Boston.
John Farrell said that was his best start of the year.
Yep.
I'm going to go with Blake Snell of the Tampa Bay Rays. 7 shutout innings of two-hit baseball with 5 Ks against the Chicago Cubs. You know, Snell, he's been injured. He's battled some tough times this year, but tonight he went out and shoved it on the Cubs. 7 shutout innings. Blake Snell, best day ever. Who's your guy at the plate?
I'm going to go to a heartbreaker for the Brewers. I'm going to Adam Frazier, second baseman, leadoff hitter for Pittsburgh. 2 for 5 tonight, 2 runs scored, 4 RBIs. But the big blow, home run, walk-off, 1 on, 2 out, 9th inning for Pirates, beating Milwaukee 6-4. And keeping them a little bit behind the Colorado Rockies.
I'm going to go to the Kansas City Royals, a team that we really didn't talk about. 15-5 are the Blue Jays, but Mike Moustakas took him forever to tie Steve Balboni. It took him forever to pass Steve Balboni, but he did it. He went 3-for-4. He had his 37th home run of the year. He is now the single-season home run record holder, passing Steve Balboni with his 37th home run of the year. Mike Moustakas, best day ever. Ned, it's all up to you now.
Let's go to the home run tracker.
MLB at the plate, home run tracker.
We've got a bunch tonight, as usual. You got Justin Bour for Florida, 426-footer, 106 miles an hour. No surprise here, Aaron Judge, yet another one. Gary Sanchez, yet another one. Gregorius for the Yankees, shortstop, surpassed Derek Jeter's highest home run total today. Gregorius, 380 feet, 101 miles per hour. Brandon Nemo, Marcus Simeon, A.J. Ellis, Clayton Kershaw's great friend, another one. Miguel Rojas, two former Dodgers for the Marlins, both 372 feet. Ellis, 1 foot more than Rojas. Giancarlo Stanton, any surprise? He homered. Any surprise? It left the ballpark. Holden, 117.
Ooh.
Miles an hour.
Hold on.
17 degrees.
117?
117 and 17 degrees. It would have knocked over the wall had it hit the wall.
Wow.
San Francisco, Brandon Crawford as they shut out Colorado 4-0. Mark Carpenter, Souza Jr., Aguilar, 440 feet, 107 miles an hour. Trey Turner for Washington, Domingo Santana, Salvatore Perez, Freddie Freeman, 439 feet, 107 miles an hour. Chris Taylor for the Dodgers, 21st of the year. Dexter Fowler, Paul DeJong again. Mookie Betts, 382 feet, 100 miles an hour. Devin Marrero, Whit Merrifield. Moustakas also for Kansas City as he passes Balboni for the all-time single-season record for the Kansas City Royals. Suzuki homered. Moncada for the White Sox, top prospect in baseball, getting it underway there with Chicago White Sox after being traded for Chris Sale last winter. David Peralta, Aaron Altair, big home run against the Dodgers. Jake Lamb, left-handed power hitter for Arizona. Tommy Joseph, him and Altair back-to-back in Philadelphia as the Dodgers fell for the 20th time in 25 games. 29-year-old Rocky Gale. Backup catcher, San Diego Padres, 353 feet. Shortest one of the night, but you know what? It all counts. 96 miles an hour. Rafi Lopez, Jace Peterson, Hunter Renfro, not once, Hunter Renfro twice. 371 the first time, 349 the second time. Adam Frazier, walk-off home run, 369, 95 miles an hour. Mitch Haniger, Christian Villanueva, J.D. Martinez, number 41, number 25 for the Diamondbacks. Then you got Odor for Texas and Nelson Cruz for Seattle. That's the home run tracker. Mm. Should we go a little statistically speaking right now?
I want to hear it, Ned.
Let's go.
Statistically speaking.
Didi Gregorius, already mentioned it, his 25th home run of the season. Who saw that coming? Breaking tie with Derek Jeter for most home runs in a season by a Yankee shortstop. Giancarlo Stanton, 56 long flies this year, most by any player since Ryan Howard hit 58 in 2006 for the fighting Phillies. Aaron Judge, third rookie in Major League history with 100 runs scored, 100 RBIs, 100 walks. No rookie had done it since the great Al Rosen in 1950, former American League MVP, former GM of the San Francisco Giants, the great Mr. Rosen. Rockies, 92% chance to make the playoffs through June 21st, down to 55 through their loss today, like a penny stock falling like crazy. Mookie Betts, 11th career home run at Camden Yards, his most home runs at any visiting park. Camden is also the only visiting park where he has double-digit home runs. Mr. Moustakas, we mentioned this a minute ago, 37th home run of the year, breaking a tie with longtime friend Steve Balboni for the franchise record in a single season. That's my longtime friend, not Moustakas's, just to be clear. He may be a friend of Moustakas, don't know. Chris Sale, fourth pitcher since 1900 with 300 strikeouts in his first season with the team. Others, Randy Johnson, 99, Nolan Ryan in 89 and 72, and the great Steve Carlton, Lefty as they used to call him, also in 1972. Sale reached 300 strikeouts in a season in 209 plus a third innings. Only Mr. Johnson, Randy Johnson, and Pedro Martinez accomplished it quicker than 209 and a third innings. There you go, Holden, statistically speaking.
That's it for the MLB at the Plate podcast. Make sure to join us on MLB on TuneIn at 7 Eastern each weeknight for MLB at the Plate. During the daily five-hour show, you'll not only hear all of what you heard in the podcast, you also have the chance to listen live to the games and get the action as it happens. For Ryan and Dustin in the LA studio and Ned Coletti alongside me, I'm Holden Kushner, and we'll catch you mañana.
Thank you for listening to the MLB at the Plate podcast, presented by National Car Rental. Go national, go like a pro. Catch us every weeknight on TuneIn, where we take you around Major League Baseball with live listenings, analysis, player interviews, and much more. Plus, be sure to check out our other great content on TuneIn, featuring the very best in sports, music, news, and talk. On TuneIn, get caught up in the moment with more than 100,000 music stations and 5 million podcasts from around the world. Exclusive sports content, including live MLB, NFL, NBA, and NHL games and 24/7 news coverage from CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News Radio. Tune in, your everything audio app.